All right, welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Ultimate Texas Podcast. We are the Rowdy Loafers, good buddy Suit Steve, Fireball Bill, and we got some Texas history. We got a whole lot of cool stuff coming out here with our good buddy Jim Hodges.
It's going to be fun.
Check us out. Welcome back, everybody. We're here with our good buddy Jim Hodges. Man, we've been going back and forth for maybe a year or so, you know, talking about your boots. And then I was like, what? You have more? You're talking about Texas history. You're talking about your writings, your books, all these great things, your history of all kinds of stuff. Let's get deep into it, because we're all about Texas culture, Texas history, good folks, supporting our friends and neighbors and all that. Can you give us like a quick, like, synopsis of your world, because I don't even know where to jump into first. I want to.
There's so much.
Yeah, get us.
Yeah. Tell us about yourself.
Well, it all started when my mother dressed me funny a long time ago.
Yeah. Okay.
No, seriously, I've had these parallel lives, so I've always run a business ever since I was 8 years old. Started training Shetland ponies for amusement parks.
Where is this? Where are we talking about?
Here in Houston.
Houston, Texas.
Right where we're sitting. Yeah.
Oh, did they have a flea circus?
Well, yeah, they did, but they didn't bother me too much. It was those bucking ponies, you know. And so I did.
We're going to interrupt you guys a lot. That's just kind of what we do. So I apologize.
Sure. No, go ahead.
Because it's really cool. Because back in the day, the Heights was the first subdivision, really, of Houston, right? So my family, again, came here in the late 1800s, breaking cattle and breaking horses. Probably break some cattle too in Central Texas, and came down here because this was the place to be. It was oil land. It was the land of opportunity, right? So people say, oh, now the Heights may be kind of yuppie, blah, blah, blah. But back, and we're trying to bring it back to the old school way. Okay. But it's good to hear folks that grew up here like yourself.
Yeah.
Doing that. Yeah.
Well, I'm an old Heights boy right there on Nicholson Street.
Okay.
So, but anyway, my life has always been parallel. So I've always run businesses, I've always worked horses. I got in the military. And to back up just a little bit, I started in Civil Air Patrol at 16, learned how to fly.
Why?
And I always loved aircraft, so I watched too many episodes of Sky King, maybe, on TV.
Okay, I can see.
You know, that was a good show, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
And, so,
why are you looking at me for that? Why, yes, it was.
It was strictly random.
There was nothing talking about.
Like the ages? I don't know. So,
anyway, I did that, so that started my military side.
Yeah.
And then went in the Army, went to Vietnam, fought there as an infantry squad leader. Came back and continued that government service all the way through today.
Did you love Vietnam, or was it something that you hated? I've had people come in here and tell us, I loved that, my time there. I thought it was fascinating and really interesting because I grew up in this life, and then it was something completely different, even though it could be horrible, of course, over there. But I don't know.
Experience, I guess. Yeah.
Right. Well, I will say this. It made a better man out of me because I grew up here. I thought this was the world. I thought that this street that I lived on was everything. And all you get is what you read in the newspaper or what your elders tell you and this, that, and the other. And I found a world that didn't exist even in my imagination. You just can't get there. The sights, the sounds, the smells, like we were talking earlier, are relative in building you into a more worldly person, and you think different, you That's react right. to things different. So it built me into a better man, albeit I would do it again if I thought I could help the people there.
Right.
But I wouldn't do it again just for the thrill of it because it was thrilling, but it's still costing me today.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But that's me in a nutshell. I stayed in law enforcement for 21 years, so I worked at local police departments, ran a federal task force for 15 years, and
it kind of took you that route. So the military aspect of it, you're getting into law enforcement, and you're finding different niches that you want to kind of pursue towards the investigation route or other things.
Sure.
Right.
And it was always that parallel life. So, you know, the horses brought me out of the war. They kind of helped me get my head back straight. And if it hadn't been for them, I'm not sure where I would be today, right, because they were all always my anchor, so to speak. And
what are you doing with the horses? You're talking about the horses here in Houston area?
Well, I was lucky. You know, when I was 16, we moved to Baytown. And that opened up a whole new world for me as well, because I got to cowboy all over the state. Yeah. And so on the weekends, I was cowboy in a rodeo. And if I was out on a summer break, I was up in North Texas herding cattle. And so I got to train some of the best horses that have ever walked this planet. And be a real cowboy, you know, back in the day.
So really training the horses. I mean, what are you doing? We roping? We cutting?
What are we? Any of it. But I like cutting more than I did any of it. Mm-hmm. And I like the ballet that those the horses are very talented, and not every horse can do it.
Man, seriously, you know. When I grew up, you know, we had a bunch of horses. We'd run stuff. My family had a ranch down in Mexico, so we'd go down there. But when I came back, I don't have the opportunity to do some of the old school way of doing it. Just, and my kids honestly don't have that opportunity anymore. And right, so I'm concerned about the future generations of good, sure, people like yourself that kind of had that perspective change of being on that. He said the ballet, oh, the horse, how amazing that animal, yeah, is, and how you can, you know, perceive that cow and do. I love that.
And being becoming one with the horse at the same time. That's amazing.
Yeah, and you know what was so cool is to take a young horse, saddle him for the first time, build his trust. And then the first time you get, you know, you manner him up and you get a good rein put on him and make an athlete out of him. But the first time you turn him loose on a cow by himself and you drop that rein and he understands.
Right.
Wow.
You become one. Right?
That's yeah, amazing. That just blows you away. So yeah, that's where I gravitated towards. I never liked the show end of it. I just don't like the show part of it. I'd get them started, put them on cattle, make get a horse out of them, and then I'd turn them over to some of my friends that showed them and made money. And so that's
always been really rodeo. You would just kind of do that for some of your friends. You'd break them in. Or did you rodeo?
Well, I rodeoed, and I found out all the girls hung out by the bull rider. So I tried that first, right? And I'm not built to be a bull rider. And so I found out real quick I was no good at it, but I was good at saddle bronc riding. And I made enough to get in old Southwest Rodeo Association, although I lied about my age, so they took my card away from me. But I did that just for a short period of time, had a lot of fun with it. But again, I didn't like the show side of it. I just wanted to be for real. Be out on the land, be out in the open, just me, the horses, and the cattle, and some really good cowboys, and real cowboys. And these guys from cant to cant. Mm-hmm. So when you leave in the morning, you can't see daylight. And when you come home at night, you can't see there either. So most of them never knew what color their own home was because they never saw it.
Right. Wow. Tough life.
Yeah.
Sounds like a song right there for sure.
But they loved it. You know, that was it. Louise O'Connor wrote that book, Crying for Daylight. Mm-hmm. And I think that one little sentence just sums the whole thing up, because that's the real cowboy. Mm. That's not a guy that wears the boots and hats and he's got a horse that he rides every once in a while.
They're living it.
That's a guy that he's in it. Yeah. He's in it for good. And so that was me. It's been a great ride. Learned a lot. I've always been like a dry sponge. Always wanted to learn everything. And school didn't teach me that.
Sure. Yeah, get out there and do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Living the life, meeting the people. As again, perspective. Your international, you know, experience there in Vietnam and other things gives you a whole nother, again, perspective on the world, and you can understand what you love and take it and educate other people and do what you love, like I said.
You bet.
You know?
And you know, I was very lucky at a young age. My grandfather was the head of the Pullman Company here in Houston, so he knew everybody. And he was also the Tyler Emeritus for Reagan Lodge right here on Hodge Boulevard.
Oh, wow.
Still is. And so every evening, his old partners got so bad their hands shook and they couldn't make a cigarette out of a whole bag of Bull Durham. So I got to sit in the middle of them and roll the Bull Durham. I got good enough. I could do it with my left hand one-handed, you know, and show off a little bit. But that was good because I was smart enough at that point in time to listen to their stories. And I wanted to learn. I didn't want to be like them. I never will forget that, because I told my dad I wanted to be just like him. And he kind of turned around and looked at me sternly, and he said, "Don't ever say that. You want to be your own man." And he said, "I'm flattered that you think that way, but," he said, "I want you to be your own man." And so that's what I strive to do, and listen to those guys and what they went through and their trials or tribulations or funny stories. But they had some really profound meanings that were hidden inside those stories, and very beneficial for a young guy coming up. And
Did you travel around America at all? Were you just doing a lot of this here in Texas, or even locally here in the Houston area?
The cowboy inside was just here in Texas. Okay. And I never got to cowboy outside of Texas, but I didn't really want to. Yeah. Be honest with you, I just kind of felt good right here, and I felt like this was
Super
my land.
Super Texan Jim Hodge.
There you go.
We can relate to that.
But anyway, that, you know, in my law enforcement roles and some other roles that I've had in government, involved quite a bit of travel. So I made a lot of states and met a lot of good folks up there in different countries. And so it was a good learning experience.
One of the coolest things, I mean, these other countries and people meeting yourself, I'm sure they you're kind of the iconic guy of Texas, right? So I'm sure they're like, oh, cowboy, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Tell us, and you tell them the stories about all your different experiences and adventures and all those things.
Yeah, it was.
I love that. And that's what we try to do here as well, is to try to embody that thing that people think of us and yourself as well.
But, yeah. Well, it's something that follows you. My business partner at one time, we were going to Phoenix to get a contract, and I showed up, and he took me to Macy's, and he told me from Chicago, and he said, you got to learn how to dress. So he takes me in there, and I get this suit made and all that, a really nice looking black pinstripe, you know, look pretty official, CEO type guy. And I walked out with my black elephant cowboy boots on, and he said, awesome. Where do you think you're going with those? Yeah. And I said, we're going to Phoenix. And he goes, you can't show up like that, because then they're going to know you're from Texas. And I said, pardon me, the minute I open my mouth, they're going to know I'm from Texas. There's exactly not a lot
this
I can
is
do.
The point.
You cannot hide. Right.
So, yeah. So yeah. He said, and don't call him partner either. And I said,
come on, man.
That ain't going to work. It's not going to work. So,
speaking of suits, hey, I got the new suit. Suit Steve right here, the Republican side. We got the Conradical, right? So it's cool. A little bit of Western yoke in the back. I got to turn around. I got to show off the
there you go.
Suit. No, oh, yeah.
Really nice.
This is our commercial time.
No. But it's cool. I mean, it is Western's cowboy. We got the kind of, what do you call this kind of pattern? Is a window pane?
It's a window pane pattern. So this particular pattern, this particular fabric, it's a wool and linen blend. It's out of Italy, and it's really breathable and cool here in Texas. I mean, it pretty much doesn't matter what time of year you are in Texas. If you have something cool and breathable, it's probably better than the alternative.
I think yesterday it was 90, and today it's like 60 or something.
So what the lesson is, Steve with Blue Fine Menswear makes Chris look good.
Yeah,
I mean, seriously. There you go. And I'm jealous. I might have to wrestle you for that.
That's what he said. Jim came in, he's like, I think I'm underdressed. Like, no, you look just great.
That's good stuff. Yeah. So tell us about, after the military and moving forward, your career moved into law enforcement, you said? And then after that, how did things go?
Well, you know, after the war, I went essentially homeless for about 2 years. So I just roamed the streets and did odd jobs and stayed out of trouble all over. I couldn't even tell you where I was, because I drank about a fifth and a half of Jack Daniels a day straight, if I could get it. And I smoked about four packs of Camel non-filters, chewed tobacco, all at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of a wreck. And again, I went back to the land. So I went out to West Texas, got a job with Happy Shahan on the Brackettville ranch there where they filmed the Alamo with John Wayne. Mm-hmm. And he was a nice guy, had me killing coyotes for bounty. And I did that for a little while. But as I went roused about it, I was in an alley and I saw this newspaper in a trash can. And it was advertising a security officer. And I looked at that picture and I thought, where did that guy go? You know, because I looked pretty bad. So I figured I could do that, and I went to a tire shop, went to work, got enough money to get a haircut and a shave, got back in uniform, got some self-respect back, and I just went straight to the top. I worked every phase of private security you can work, from armored cars all the way up to corporate security, the whole deal. And law enforcement was another big step. And at my Vietnam experience actually paid off, because in 1979, now they call it BATF, but in those days it was ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. They came and got me, and they had the Vietnamese shrimpers and the American shrimpers going to war on the Texas coast. Mm-hmm. And they didn't know how to handle the Vietnamese. So I went in and signed on with their task force. Within 2 months, I was already leading that task force. And
you understand their culture, maybe a little bit of some words here and there.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And, you know, the whole idea was not to see who we could arrest. The idea was to see if we could infiltrate both sides, tease them a little bit, and then get them to come together and say, here's how we heal this wound and we stem off this civil war that's fixing to take place. And so that experience in Vietnam really helped me. And one of my specialties that I can talk about was psychological warfare.
Sure.
So in Vietnam, I had a Kit Carson scout, and we developed a plan, and he flew in a J-3 Cub over the Ho Chi Minh trails and was talking in Vietnamese over a loudspeaker telling them, the war's over with, drop your weapons and go home. And they did.
Right.
They did. So we used those same tactics. We sold people a bunch of goods that they thought was the real thing, and it turned out later to kind of blow up in their face. But it was a good thing. And we brought them both to the peace table. We got the U.S. government to understand how they caused that problem in the first place and what it was going to take to alleviate it. And so it was a very successful operation. We had everybody either dead or locked up by 1983. Hmm. So a very short run, but people have no idea.
I was going to say, no one had a clue.
No.
I mean, there's some interesting and maybe some bad things or some deviant, whatever you want to call it, but probably saved a lot of lives at the end of the day, probably saved a lot of the economy and all those kinds of
things. We did, because you know what people don't ever see is the shadow world. You know, these are people that are working right next to you. Your eyes and your intellect are not trained to see them. They're invisible. And they were coming in here. They knew there was money in it. So they had instigators, filibusters that were trying to bust up each side and fill them full of money and guns and ammo. And they raided caches down in South America, even World War II ordnance, and brought it up here.
Oh, wow.
So it was getting serious.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we were able to stem that out. But that's kind of been the rewarding side of all of that pain and misery I went through in the Vietnam War, is to be able to use it for something that's positive to help. And I think that's always been my thing. I'm guilty
of time, Jim. I mean, it's all about that perspective. You go do something like right now, I go to Kazakhstan every single month, right? And it's hard. But I understand the Russian people and how they live and work, and I take that perspective and I try to, you know, help in different ways here in my homeland. Or again, living in Italy for a long time, you can see what people perceive of Texas and bring it back. However you do it, good, bad, whatever, but I see there's a lot of good stuff that comes out of sometimes you don't realize, you know.
I think it's probably
there's two sides to everything. Yeah,
there is.
You don't see it.
You know, the definition of success in a lot of ways is to be able to take any bad experience you have and somehow learn from it.
You bet.
And be able to apply it somewhere else and make something better.
Well, you better laugh out of it. That's amazing.
Yeah, and, you know, my old saying was you can't really appreciate good unless you've seen the bad. Because we won't.
Yeah.
People are very abusive to themselves and others, unintentionally sometimes. And we do that out of ignorance, not necessarily on purpose.
Yeah, sure.
But, you know, things like that are very rewarding, including seeing some of the Vietnamese youngsters now that I've worked with. They don't know anything about that war.
Mm-hmm.
But the good part is they speak very clear and concise English because in junior high, they're required to speak English from then on.
Right.
Which is kind of cool. And they're Western in the way they commercialize and capitalize their business things. So that was the payoff for me, is that they have a life that they would have never had we not been there and been involved. They would have never seen that, never been exposed to it. They would have been in a communist sheet system, just like everybody else. No individualism. And, you know, state-owned factories and commercial places. But now, you know, it leaves room for good stuff. And so I'm always excited when I meet young folks like that.
We don't talk a lot of politics on here, but it is true that the communist system, and I've been working and living in that environment for a long time. It does shield you a bit, and I'm always big on Texas history and culture and reteaching that because of our individualistic identity as Texans. right? Mm-hmm. The people that came here, just get out of my way. Let me do stuff. We'll take care of our own. Give every stray dog a good home. I'm quoting a Lane Williams song over here.
Yeah.
But it's very true. We sing that song here probably too often than we probably should. But,
no, it's not too often.
But we love Texas, and that individualistic kind of culture creates, you know, entrepreneurship and other things that kind of build that, so the people that come here can have that enlightenment, as we say. And it's kind of sad that some people are oppressed. So trying to bring that to the world is great. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Texas is a really good example of that, because it was such a mixture of cultures. I have people all the time. I go speak all over the U.S. and other places. But they're misled that Texas somehow or another, you know, Texans grew out of the dirt.
Right.
And you can't be one, you know, unless you're born and raised here and all that. But that's absolutely false.
That's,
you know, those
false
of it that know the truth, that it was just a mixed match, still is. You know, it's a state of mind. And those people came here to build dreams and to fabricate something that would take care of posterity down the road. And that's something that you don't learn in the history books or any of that till you talk to the old timers and their descendants and their families,
right,
how they benefited from all of those sacrifices that they made, you know,
yeah,
going through the revolutions and plural and, of course, statehood and then, you know, becoming a republic. And so you change all of that, and you got six flags flying over this country. That's amazing.
It is amazing. And, again, you kind of hit on it a little bit, but it is that – It didn't happen with just a bunch of Anglo settlers coming across. I mean, mm-hmm, this was happening with the Tejanos and even some of the Indian tribes even before that. But really in San Antonio, where you had the 1813 revolution, you had the first Declaration of Independence from Texas, right? Those were the Republican Army of the North, Tejanos, against the centralist, you know, royalist forces, and they had the Battle of Medina, killed, mm-hmm, you know, it was the bloodiest battle in Texas. That's before 1836. We're talking 1813, right?
Right.
And these are happening because of that individualistic nature in Texas that preceded all these things that we, you know, come and take it and all that. It, mm-hmm, happened before. It's
sure
always been like this.
Yeah.
Not always, but, you know, in modern history it has been like this.
Yeah. I like those stories, too, that I never heard about growing up, and I learned about them later, but that was people that could have been bitter enemies, the Comanches versus all of these settlers coming in. But you had people like the founders in Fredericksburg.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they never had a fight with them. They just were able to make this peace and understand they could help each other. Charles Goodnight, one of my favorite studies, and I actually got to be the voice of Charles Goodnight on a video we did. Wasn't
that
cool?
Incredible.
Huh? Yeah. And
that's
nobody gets cool to be the voice of Charles Goodnight, but
you did.
But I did.
You got
and,
the voice.
Oh, he was.
That's a big deal.
You know, but he was a
I'm not sure if it was all the
know
cigarettes back in the day or something like that that he was talking about.
That may have been. May have been. But he was such a great guy, you know, and he became friends with the Indians, and they survived and lived together and worked together, and he was friends with Quantum Parker and et cetera, et cetera. You know, it just goes on. So all these stories mainly are about bad things that happen. You know, if you watch a lot of Westerns, all you see is just this fighting all the time. But that was by and large not true. There was a lot of people that really came here to do the right thing, and they were able to have the self-leadership to carry that out. And that's admirable, because that's, you know, you're in a foreign land. You got people that have been here for eons, who knows, and you got to find some equal footing. And I can't even imagine that. I try to put myself in that position.
It's,
but,
no,
you know, Charles Goodnight to me was just, he was like a beacon in the night. You know, he was just the right guy at the right time at the right place. And Quantum Parker was the same way. And
mm-hmm,
you could just
with
start.
Right heart. Yeah.
You bet, yeah. And you could name them off. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And it's a shame the monument to that in Fredericksburg is kind of hidden, you know, in the park back there. You don't see it unless you actually go back there and look. But they still every year celebrate that peace treaty, and it was never broken. That was the only one in the United mm-hmm States that
wow
never, to this day, was ever broken. And that's all the kudos in the world, you know.
What?
We're almost done.
So, yeah? No, we're gonna do this for another 5 hours. We were just, because I was just thinking.
Producer.
No, I know. We were just with our good buddy, Terry Booth, And you need to meet Terry Booth.
Oh, I got you.
He's a Texas historian. We were there last week, and he created the West Pole in Bee Cave, Texas, which is where the West starts. It's on the – I can't tell the right
– The meridian. Yeah. We got to
– But, yeah, so they would run all the cattle, and you know, Charles Goodnight possibly stayed in this area that they were running the cattle up to Kansas and such, but it's fascinating. People that love Texas and understand all these difficulties – but also the good stuff of these alliances with the Germans and the Comanches and the Apaches and the difficulty of the Apaches and the Chronkawa and all these things going on. It's very complicated, but to me, fascinating history. So, but you got to meet Terry Booth. I'm going to make this happen.
Yeah,
it absolutely should happen.
Yeah, he's got a homestead out there in Bee Cave now. Surrounded, they sold off their land because of the Galleria there on 71. But if you go down on Little Barton Creek there, they've got the original homestead. And they do
mid 1800s.
Yeah,
it's a blacksmith shop, and it's beautiful.
Wow,
gorgeous. It's very Texas.
Super yeah, we worked Texas. On the Alamo movie right there in Bee Cave.
Yeah,
yeah, sure. Reimer yeah. Ranch.
Yeah, because
I'm sure he was
even the Lonesome Dove set with the bar scene.
He's got
the original inside of this place.
Oh, really?
Yes. Wow. He has all that.
It's a real deal. It's awesome.
I'll write that one down. That's necessary. I get a meeting with him.
Did you write some books?
I did.
Well, let's hear about
these books. Let's talk about
it. I had two books. The first one is called Texas Longhorns Short Essay. And this was an essay I wrote in 1998. And a friend of mine, Dr. Wayne Hanselka, told me he wanted to read the essay. And that was several years ago, and I said, man, I don't even think I can find that. You know, it was a long time ago. So I did find it, and I had to rewrite it because I had it all crumpled up in some files. And he said, no, I don't want that. I want a book. I want something I can put in my library that's part of you. And I said, all right. So I was flattered because he's a J. Frank Dobie addict. Yeah. And, you know, all
this.
He's a great guy. He's well-read, very smart fella. And so I said, man, that's flattering. So I expanded the outline, put some photos in there, and out came the Texas Longhorn book. And it's a short essay, so it's not 500 pages of Texas Longhorns.
So Bill can actually read it, maybe. Is that pictures in here?
Pictures?
It's a picture. Oh,
there you go.
Picture book.
Yeah, there you go.
There is pictures.
You look at the pictures. And
yeah, Bill, you can read this. Okay.
I got it.
So it's got some good photos of me and my horses.
He knows
in
you
there.
Well.
Yeah, there you go. And then the other one is from the darker side, and this is from my law enforcement side. And this
Red
is
rum.
Called Murder Above Top Secret. And this was the real murder of Donald Charles Neal. And he was an electrical engineer for McDonnell Douglas, but he worked directly for Ronald Reagan on developing the Star Wars killer satellite. So the Russians developed a satellite. They could reach out with an arm and grab our satellites and jerk them out of orbit. So we had to counter. And Don Neal got the nod. Unfortunately, it cost him his life. So he was tortured to death in 1983 in a little apartment in Webster, Texas.
Okay.
Wow. And he was a real eccentric type guy. So this takes people – I wrote it for two reasons. Number one, it's the official record of the murder. And number two, it might help solve it at some point in time. It's still unsolved since 1983. And I'm still working on that. I never give up. I owe that much to Don Neal. So, but it takes you through the world of espionage. And this is something, I've had a lot of people buy it and they read it and they say, I'm sorry I couldn't finish it. It's just, I don't want to think that kind of stuff goes on.
Yeah.
But he lived a life of in that underworld. And there were people after him all the time. So there was two old Soviet bloc KGB agents after him. There was an East German contract agent after him. And my job was to keep them off of him. Unfortunately, they got to him because he had another side nobody could see. And so he snuck away, got loose out of protection, and it got him. And so this is a story of not only his murder, but it's a story of kind of all of us. You know, it's a way nowadays it's common knowledge that SDI is up there, and most people don't know what.
It's all alive and well.
Yeah, and so you know, and lasers are like secondhand now. But in 1983, there was only three people that knew about that project. One was President Reagan. The second one was Lieutenant General Graham, and the third one was Don Neal. There was not anybody inside that project. Nobody. CIA, DIA, FBI, nobody knew about it. Just the three. So that's how, when it says above top secret, that's what it was. So I thought it would be a good eye-opener for people that want to kind of get a better understanding of what goes on day in and day out worldwide. Yeah. And number two, if you never know about a murder case. You know, somebody could just come out of the woodwork cold turkey and say, I did it, or something could happen, you know, to wind up being what you don't think of. And but he was tortured to death in that apartment for those secrets, I believe. And there's some pretty spooky stuff in there, too. Three guys disguised as FBI agents walked into the police department and told them they're not cleared high enough to have this evidence, so they took it. Mm. Now, you would think police officers would be more adapt to, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, let's see your credentials. Let's where'd that come from? You know, you're just showing up cold turkey with a U-Haul truck to haul the stuff off. So anyway, that it's he had designed all kinds of electrical things in his apartment, and he was just an eccentric. I mean, his stuff is piled up to the roof. It was so dark in there you couldn't see because of the brown mold on the wall over the years. And so it was a tough case. So those are my two books. One from the light side and the other from the dark side.
Talk about your parallel. Yeah, you've got two different things kind of.
And those are y'all's, by the way, so you can pass them around. And
right.
We'll read these.
I want to read it.
Darn yeah. Right. And they have pictures in there for Bill.
I'm wrestling for it.
Thank you.
We always do the boot of the week, Jim, so that just kind of show what we got going on here. So we have a come and take it and don't tread on me. Being a patriotic guy, you know, you're loving these kinds of things. Very Texas. Very, I guess, Americana here. So just some good elephant boots here. And, yeah, we do everything. But we always got to show a couple of really cool boots, so we'll make that quick. How can we find you? I mean, are you on social media? Do we have a website for you? Do people want to learn more about Jim Hodges?
Mm-hmm. So my website is www.cowboyspeaks.com.
Okay.
So it's very easy to find that.
I like
My Facebook site is open, so if anybody wants to follow me on Facebook, they can just look me up on there. Very simple. And other than that, that's about all the social media I need.
Yeah, no, yeah, you don't need
it. It keeps me busy enough.
Do you have any more literature or writings coming about in the near future?
I've got two books. Okay. One I'm trying to get cleared, and I'm stumbling over for the last 12 years, but it's my autobiography, and it's called The Dark Side of a Bright Sun. Sun is S-O-N. S-O-N. And that's kind of gives you the whole smear, but it actually takes people on that dark side, that journey that I don't talk about.
Right.
And I'm trying to get some of that cleared where I can actually put that out. And I've got another cowboy book. It's called I'm an Old Cow Hand. And just a plain story about cowboys and horses that I knew and I rode with that really deserve to be in the Hall of Fame. And they didn't want that. They just wanted to be out there on the land. So those are the two that are kind of on the back burner right now.
Awesome.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, hats off to you.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Both sides. Yeah. I mean, the war side and then the law enforcement side and everything else, the Texas cultural side and the cowboy, all those things.
I know, right?
So many things.
It's got it all.
Thank you. Thank you for your service.
We're privileged to have you here.
Well, thank you for having me out here. This is wonderful. And hopefully there's some, excuse me, some young folks out there that are kind of like I was, you know, and they'll hear this and they'll be inspired to do great things.
That's why we
not just read one book, but
that's right.
Read them all. You know,
got to keep this alive. This is extremely important for everybody, right? So let's try to immortalize these moments in time. You know, that's why we do these things. So again, thank you, Jim.
It's wonderful.
Thank you
for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
Cheers, guys. Appreciate it.
Cheers.
Yeah.
The last stuff.